40 years experience in bringing proprietary advances to market. He specializes in rapid commercialization, and he has over 22 years in the aerospace industry and a whole list of other things which were too many and numerous to list. And rather than go through and read all of these things, I sent out the announcement to everyone so that you could see it and review it. And I'm going to do this. Wow. Is that you? You're in.
Rick, do you like to be interrupted or do you want us to stay quiet?
Thank you for the question. As soon as I can get on the screen, Doug, could you help me here?
Yeah, sure.
I'm just,
if I'm standing here,
where should I click? To get
it? Here.
Oh, wait.
Where's your presentation?
Sorry, it's over here.
Let me see if I can do that. Open.
Or you right click, yeah.
I right click the open, it's open okay. PowerPoint. And now if I hit F5, can I do this for a living?
I'm so glad.
We'll figure out how to get paid for it.
I said that because he's a faculty member, right?
Okay.
I would love interruption, and it doesn't matter how long we go. You're the judges of when you have to leave. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks to Bob. Probably it might be useful to fill in the second half of that 40 plus years. I did start out of the Navy in National Research Corporation, which some of you may have remembered was Dick Morse's high value company in Cambridge, Mass. There we perfected the penicillin process during the Second World War. The Minute Maid orange juice freeze dye process, and then proceeded to develop advanced propellants and cryogenic and simulating space as we began our space effort. After Sputnik, we got into some serious work in that area, as the rest of us did back then. And I continued there until I joined Ross Perot and EDF. So that was where I got my first taste of computers and programming, which I didn't like very much, sorry to say. It was hell going through understanding how to program a 1401. And I was better at sales in that organization. So I got us contracts in Texas and then up in New York and helped open the New York office. But Continental Can called me into corporate development, and I headed up the new business development and corporate technology at Continental Group, which was the largest packaging company in the world at the time. We used more aluminum for our aluminum cans than any other one company in the world at the time. We owned part of Metalbox, which was in the UK and worldwide company. We were in South America and Europe in a big way, but then a raider came on the scene, and the company was broken up, and the reason you haven't heard of Continental Can is that it exists no longer. Not even the name is used by anyone. To show you what can happen in our day and age, or in the last century's day and age anyway, a lot of the can and plastic container and paper businesses, of course, went to other owners as the whole company was broken up. But that was in the early 80s then, as President Reagan started his term, when I started my own business, which is what I am going to talk about today, and that represents the last 22 years of my time. I have some simple handouts of the simple six slides that I've made talk to you around today, and some more have come in. So I hope I think I do have enough here. If each one of you would like a copy of it, I'll divide it over here about roughly, maybe. Thanks. Will you make notes and interrupt and ask questions and correct me as you go?
Thank you.
see from your faces, as well as some few things that Bob has had a chance to tell me, that you're all very knowledgeable, experienced. You probably have a lot of wounds from working in this whole area of developing new technology for the market. It is the most complex process known to man, I call it, other than our own created beings. And I like to work in it hip deep with partners that I have these days, primarily serving the large industrial. So I'm not as proficient or don't work as deeply in software or in medical as I try to work in purely industrial areas. And that would include what I would define as four disciplines: materials, including all advanced materials and our understanding of materials, all the way down to nanomaterials these days, all the way up to structures. The second area is electromechanics. As we understand more and more about materials, we're able to design and develop and introduce much more effective electromechanical products. For instance, in Northampton is a company called EchoAir that I have stock in and know well and work with, which is, I see one of you smiling, which has developed the most effective alternator that we have in the world today in terms of size, weight, and power, or efficiency, if you want to call it that. I'll often refer to SWAP because that's one of the measures that the Department of Defense uses often to determine whether or not something reaches or passes or gets over the hurdle of something they're interested in: size, weight, and power. So what Pete Knutson has developed at EchoAir is really a true innovation out of an understanding of electromagnetics, but also advanced materials. And so there's two areas: materials, electromagnetics, the third is electronics, admittedly extremely broad, but in that area I tend to focus on those things which utilize compound semiconductor materials to do new things that we couldn't do with plain silicon before, in terms of detection, in terms of laser development and use of lasers with different wavelengths. That gets me over into photonics, which is the science of that is replacing electronics in so many areas. Of course, we've all known about the work at Bell Labs years ago with an optimistic plan to make a computer using photons. That has yet to come on the scene. But we are now developing photonic devices that not only are superior detectors and emitters, but ways of transferring the photons without using electronics across connections, so that in one case the Department of Defense is hoping that eventually we'll be flying by light as opposed to wires. We'll use photons going through fiber optics to transmit signals of information as well as signals for actuation of the devices, strictly through fiber optics, without muxing through electronics across a board or from a board to board or a board to backplane or across a bulkhead and back from electronics to photonics. It takes a lot of space, weight, and power to do. So these are some of the things that are going to happen in photonics in the future, and that again is an area in which I work. I'd also like to say that where I focus, and that is in that space between the inventor and the user, the ultimate user of the technology in the form of a real application that does something that is a major advance. But I start pretty much downstream in terms of the technology and its stage. And I want to mention technology readiness levels as we get downstream a little more in this discussion. And maybe some of you would be interested in how DOD is using technology readiness levels and how they defined it. And I have the full definition of all the stages of TRL here for you, anyone who's interested afterwards. And you will find that major industrials are now beginning to use technology readiness levels. Parker Hannifin is one. A friend of mine, CTO of Parker Hannifin, has caused that to be introduced as one of the ways to define where the technology is in the R&D pipeline to commercialization. And so TR levels are very finely defined and very easy to understand. And I would guess that some of us are going to start to use TR levels more and more widely, because it immediately communicates whether where an invention is in its development towards commercialization. So I'm mentioning that because as I look for what I call young technology companies, who, as Doug was pointing out in his introduction, to me are companies that have a management, not every discipline filled, maybe, or function, but have a founder and a chief scientist and a CEO, and they define where they're going with the technology, and it has more than one field of use with lots of protection in the form of patents, provisional patents, patents applied for, secrecy, know-how, employee agreements, nicely controlled with more than one field of application. And that's a company which may only be at a TR level 4 or 5 today, but it has demonstrated on the bench a working prototype, at least. And indeed, it does have more than one field of application, such as maybe one in medicine, another in environmental detection of toxic chemicals, so on. The management or owners of that technology are very willing to partner with an industrial company. It might be a pharmaceutical or a medical device company, although I don't really work in that area very much, but mostly an industrial, where in the case of a better solution to the lithium battery membrane, we avoid fires in laptops, and there's interest on the part of a large company to bring that advance in the complex material of the membrane system into lithium batteries and bring it to market. And that company is willing to do that. They have other technology in their basic technology that is applied to blocking IR and UV in windows, for instance. It's a sol-gel company, sol-gel chemistry company. Targeting security markings, invisible barcodes, so to speak, that you can read with IR. And that's all within the sol gel chemistry capability of this one company.
Question. Typically, does the management understand of the IP applications beyond their initial area of focus, or do you bring that perspective to them?
They understand it, and they know about it, they thought about it, they dreamed about it, slept on it, and they're the ones to tell me.
Okay.
And so, no, I don't have to, but they don't know who to talk to about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I come in with the contacts I've developed in industry, where I can go to them then, the CTO usually, or sometimes the group vice president or the CEO, and say, I know your strategy well enough, I know your culture, here's a technology over here I think will fit right into a gap that you want to fill, as we were talking about earlier, a white space, an opportunity for you with a large company. So the young company management has to be willing to enter into some kind of joint development agreement. Not feeling, the opposite is to feel like you've got to guard your technology until you can fully develop it and show the world. That often takes too long to get there. These steps I'm talking about will get you there a lot faster in many cases if the right deal can be put together. So a lot of the companies I find are funded through the grant program in small business innovation research, which, as you know, many of you, was transacted by Congress in the early 80s and results in $3 to $4 billion a year these days from the budgets, off the top of the budgets, around 2% now, of the total budget of every agency in the federal government, throws that amount of money from their budget into the pot that represents the SBIR program. And I work with NSF on reviewing phase one and phase two proposals for that. But I sit on a panel, a permanent one, for the Missile Defense Agency, where we actually interview the company itself that comes in having won a phase two SBIR. And these most of these companies, but unfortunately not there are too many of them that are not at the stage where they have done all the right things. Do have technology that's protected and is ready to link with a large organization to bring it to market. So, in the course of, again, just by way of introduction towards some principles that I want to get into with you, that fills in more of the background of where I'm coming from. So hopefully you understand better what my particular experience is. Bob and I share a lot in terms of our approach to opportunities in leveraging technology. But I've been an industrial type of guy, whereas, if I may say so, Bob has been focusing more on the consumer product side of things. And not that I don't get into consumer products, and I'm not working on some things right now with a major industrial where we're going to consumer products, but in that case, I'm working with a guy named Dick Sperry, who brought Instapak to Sealed Air. And Dick Sperry is a prolific inventor and a consumer products guy, among many other things. So I would need, that, although Continental Can had some learnings there for me in terms of consumer products when I was in corporate, I'm not a consumer products guy practicing today. Please interrupt me anytime if you've got a question or I say something weird that just doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you like to see technologies with multiple applications.
Yes.
I'm wondering how you deal with the conflict that many entrepreneurs have that while their technologies may have multiple applications, investors from VCs to early stage VCs to angels tend to like to get venture very, very focused. And there's a tendency to even dismiss companies that aren't focused and want to go after many applications. I'm wondering how you deal with that.
Covering that. That's an excellent point. There's a part of what I was saying that I didn't even fill in because you need to have this question. And that is that in that case, the VCs dictate a spin-out and a setup of a separate company. When there's a large industrial who is going to throw in the necessary resources of market presence and manufacturing that they can bring to that equation, then VCs are usually even more interested because they can see the large industrial as their exit strategy. They'll buy the company someday and buy out the VCs at a nice multiple, which they always look for within 5 to 7 years. So yeah, in those cases where you're going to go right ahead and set up where you're going to attract VC or angel money, like you're referring to, at that stage where you start the joint development with a large company, you have to set up a spin-out company. and the parent company, the original owner of the technology, he has a stake still in the technology of the new spin-out company. There's usually a rights back to the originating company, so that their IP portfolio is further strengthened by discovery and implementation by the spin-out company, and they feed new invention into the spin-out company. There's an arrangement like that usually. But the spin-out company becomes a standalone entity with VC investment or angel investment, part ownership by the originating company where the technology came from, and the strategic investor. It's hard to put that together, and they're rare, because you have to get too many parties to agree to too many things. Usually what happens is that you go down the road towards some product-proved development, and you've got an original market application which demonstrates the efficacy of the technology and application. And then the parent company, the originator of the technology, and the strategic investor make a deal where it's either bought totally by the strategic investor, or they both sell it to a VC, who then puts the cash in to develop it further and take it to market and public ownership. That's also rare. Usually it goes to the industrial who originally invested in it. Did I answer that enough at this point? Good. I have found through the years that one of the most useful things to talk about, and it's sort of the spirit of this little presentation, is that it's difficult to see what reality is when you have a good idea. That's not all bad, because enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness is absolutely necessary. But the problems that so many inventors have had is understanding where the limitations are in their technology, and then therefore attracting the parties to work with them to fill in the weaknesses that they have or that the technology has. So I'm trying to address that in a few notes that I'll cover here, with the hope that, although I'm going to say a lot of things that you already know, that any discussion we have and anything I say would maybe emphasize some things that are useful to you in the case of what you're now sitting here thinking about working on and developing and bringing into the marketplace. So that's why I titled it this way. So it all involves recognizing reality, and then I want to cover action steps, action items, and then some details about how and why some things need to be so closely adhered to. Industry, as you know, in their strategic planning for decades has been using SWOT analysis: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. The strategic plans of most major industrials that I've worked in or worked with, and as well small companies, have now tried to put together SWOT analyses every year in their strategic plans. Attempt internally, as far as their managers are able to define what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and what the opportunities are in the marketplace that they serve, and the threats to them. If you want, in a prospectus you have risks. These are the threats. So I've sort of pattern these few remarks to account for that way of putting together all of the things that need to be thought about in order to bring something into the marketplace. In terms of experience, what I mean there is that if a company, an inventor, a young company, a new company, you may not have formed a company yet, but if you have an invention and you feel, of course, that it's going to be useful to somebody or you wouldn't be interested in bringing it along, an undeniable reality point is to realize that there's a certain set of experience sets that need to be brought to bear to bringing that invention into the marketplace. Now, that the ideal setup in a young high-tech company that I deal with is the following. The founder, the scientist, must have at least 5, maybe ideally 15 to 30 years experience in the industry that the invention is going to be born out of and or address. And that experience must be complemented by finance, manufacturing, and sales, you don't need legal there yet, but you've got to have those 5 functional experience set in your set of people that you're maybe now very informally talking to as you think about the invention, but experience in the industry and or the science that the invention is being born out of is absolutely essential. And I only say that because although we're all able to imagine by the gifts that are given us by Almighty God, incredible ideas, they have to be tempered with somebody who's in there. And it's only because genius can have only a certain amount of input to what's going to become reality in terms of the marketplace. I've seen too many geniuses who retain somehow control of the company, spend all the money and drive the company into the ground, even with strong boards. And I was one-on-one with others who were strong board members. But the genius could not, as bright as he was, get his mind up down out of the clouds. He was going to show IBM what a flat panel display could really do that no one was working on yet. And so we should have been working on signage, which would have been the first logical market entry. And he kept focusing on feeding LCDs, plasmas, and electromagnetic waves with his technology. We should have known better and gotten the experience in there and or done something about this blind spot that he had. But the other part of the thing that I wanted to talk about in my experience has shown is that in the team must be able to work together very well. They must have hopefully worked together in another company for some period of years. That's ideal again. I'm talking ideals here, just to set your thinking up, or all of us are thinking up, in terms of assuring the best chance of success. That's what I mean about assessing the strength of your idea as you begin to think about building a business around it in terms of experience. I do have a... There's not a overhead projector here, is there, Doug? We don't have one here. I don't want to interrupt us all by getting one, but I have what I use myself, which I use on my own studies, a technology evaluator. And under management, I also include the investors They have to have strong experience in the industry and the market being addressed. So investors are equally logical as members of your experience team, because if you don't need a board yet, that's all right, board of directors. But you ought to have an informal board of advisors, which would include people you found as you work through your years that you trust, whose judgment you trust, whose experience you trust. And they often will be interested in helping you with these assessments that you need to make sure that you're facing reality about the prospects for success in your venture. I knew a venture capitalist once who on his desk had a one of these things with your, normally with your name on it, and it said WIR. And I knew his name, that weren't the initials of his name. And after a while, from talking with him, I said, "What does that mean, John?" And he said, "I get so many people in here telling me that they should put my money or the fund's money into their ideas, and I simply end up pointing to that." And I said, "Well, what does it mean?" He said, "What is reality?" Because, you know, you can become so enthusiastic that your feet are not solidly on the ground. So I wanted to emphasize that. I probably have gone too far with it. Intellectual property, of course, can take many forms. You don't have to have patents if your idea can be protected by secrecy, trade secrets. Particularly processes are nicely subject, like the Coca-Cola formula or other inventions that involve chemistry, with locked up knowledge of formulas that no one is going to have access to, and that can be your intellectual property. Because once you patent something, of course, although you can withhold a lot of the details from a patent and all the claims, you can build a business around trade secrets. It's not done often, and it's difficult to get others to invest in your company. More difficult if you're not going for patents. Again, going back to this gentleman's point, the venture capitalists feel that if all else fails, at least the IP is worth something, and it can be, in that case, they need to have it in the form of patents that they can turn around and salvage something out of the business. So it's not a good way to build yourself to the point where you're going to get investment or sell your company early on, in my experience. Other strength and weakness factor is degree of difference in application. What I mean by that is that the cost and performance factors need to be compelling. Cost needs to be not 20% or 30% better that you're able with a good margin to price your product to the customer. It needs to be hopefully one-tenth of the cost of anybody else providing the same solution. I don't mean the same technology or the same product, but providing the same solution in the marketplace. That's ideal. Again, I'm talking ideals, targets, you know, to shoot for. And therefore, then you can add on a nice margin of 50% or more and still price your product or your service under the competition, under what the customer is paying right now for the same solution. So that's what I mean by cost, the degree of difference in application, in the application that you decided to shoot for first. And of course, performance needs to be equally compelling, with not just the percentage better of 10, 20, 30%, but ideally an order of magnitude better.
Rich, could you backtrack just a little bit and explain what types of clients are looking for these, you know, technologies?
Yes.
and how you play with how you play this role. You're the person who, or the group that makes the decisions based on these criteria. But who are your clients? What type of companies are your clients, and what type of companies do you buy for them? Do you arrange for them to buy?
In that I've mentioned that I've been dealing with industrials primarily, I mean companies like Parker Hannifin. They are a big valve control and aerospace components company, headquartered in Cleveland, at about $12 billion. I'm working with them right now, the reason I mentioned that first. But over the years, I've worked with United Technologies, Engelhard Corporation, which is part of BASF now, with Union Carbide before they spun out Praxair, and then Praxair, the industrial gas company, from them. Then they went, Union Carbide went to, Dow Buckman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Roman Haas, whom Dow just bought. Roman Haas, the big specialty chemicals company, still headquartered in Philadelphia. With TRW before they were acquired by Northrop Grumman, with Mark Marietta before they were acquired by Lockheed Martin, with Lockheed Martin, with IPT. But packaging companies, even toy companies. I haven't dealt with any toy companies, but I know Dr. Johnson in Atlanta, who invented the gun, the water gun. He came to a missile defense agency meeting that I.
But I mean, they say to you, we're looking for this technology, and you go find it? Or do you find technology and say, hey, these guys might need it? Or do you do both?
The latter.
You find technology and say, I know a place for you.
Right.
And how do you know this? I mean, are you,
I'm omniscient.
No, I'm just curious. I mean, obviously you know these people.
The way I know it is so to speak, is I studied the large company, and I get an appreciation for what their strengths are, and I get to know some of the senior managers as far up as I can go. Usually I can't get to the CEO just on a get-to-know-you basis, but the CTO kind of likes to talk to me, and we hit it off right away usually. And then some division and group heads and I will talk. And that way I get an idea of who's open and who's not, who's, you know, steeped in meeting this month's budget and this quarterly's profit sharing and doesn't want to look at anything different or new, and somebody who's open and sees the long run, the big picture. But more importantly, I just read the annual report and I see where they're saying there are strategic thrust that they've defined in their annual report they're going after. And you know the CEO is always tasked to get that message out because the shareholders want to know where their company is going. And so, for instance, back in the early 80s, I went to Olin Corporation and I said, I see you're working in, they had their whole annual report around water, pure water, because they were already long since in pool chemicals for years, but John Hinsky, the CEO at the time, decided that he wanted Olin to get into other ways of purifying water for other applications besides pool water. And weren't there other ways other than adding chemicals to, such as UV or whatever? And so they hired me for a year to go out and look for companies all across the country that had innovations in purifying water. IPT is doing the same thing today. They've definitely designated water as one of the areas they want to be proficient in and be a leader in.
And so you're actually arranging for them to buy these high technology or new technology companies, including their management style and all that, or just to incorporate the idea? How does that help?
Well, all those complexities that you fully appreciate and to which you're referring have to be handled in terms of the best approach in each case.
Right.
Usually, you don't want to have the small company bought by the large company because history shows that kills the
Amen.
So, big companies know that. They don't go for that anymore. Unless it's something that strategically is extremely important to them and they better own it, or their competitors will, and they'll pay enough to the founders who are usually smart enough to have other ideas in the background that they can, once they've accumulated their 10 or 50 million to go and pursue, and they're happy to sell their company, lock, stock, and barrel.
You mean sell, or also licensing comes into play as well?
Well, I was going to get to that.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob. Because I didn't want to be misleading there, because it's rare that that's the case, as you all know. But usually what happens is that where the technology has more than one field of use, the founders and owners are left with all the ability after they've received an upfront payment and they can expect royalties down the street for the technology that they're licensing to the big company. They're happy then to go and focus their attention on these other fields of use and develop their technology there. And usually it's only a commercial / licensing agreement. There's no equity in the small company initially. Sometimes the large company wants to have more of a piece and might be interested in another field of application this technology represents. And then they'll ask for an equity position, or they'll take the step to offer a total buyout. But initially, the way people are doing it today, big corporations and little ones, is to license in one field. That leaves the little company free to continue to pursue their dreams.
And it's usually a royalty arrangement?
Pardon?
It's usually a royalty arrangement then?
It's always a royalty arrangement, but it should include an upfront payment, a sizable upfront payment. And typical is $250,000 upfront because there's a period of time of a year or more where the joint development is going to go on, and that company, the small company, is restricted from, by agreement, from pursuing any other partners in that area. So they have to be paid for that opportunity cost by the big company.
Is this against royalties?
And no, that should not be against royalties. And then royalties hopefully will start coming later, 2-3 years down the road.
Okay. Yeah. Those are typically option fees.
That's an option. Pardon?
Your option fees.
Option. Well, that's really, I call it an option fee too.
Right.
Yeah. Yes,
sir. I have a question about intellectual property. And you may not remember, we met before on my Prax Air Day. Anyway.
Bruce.
I'm Mark Militarski.
Mark, you are?
Yeah.
Great to see you.
Yeah.
I do remember you so well, yeah. Yeah, you were sliding circuit boards over baths of
That's right.
And many other things. Oh, it's great to see you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
But my question is this. In the manufacturing industry, are there any pockets of pain when it comes to patents?
Please say that again, please.
In the manufacturing industry,
are there any pockets
of pain?
Well,
for example, in the software industry, there's a huge problem with patents. Maybe also in pharma. My sense is the manufacturing industries are okay. They may not be happy. But I'm just wondering, from your perspective, is there any areas where there's just real problems?
Oh, you're asking me if I know about areas
where the patent office
need to be filled with solutions.
No, where the patent office just isn't doing its job.
I haven't heard of any, Mark.
Okay.
You probably know of some cases. Every patent, every guy going for patent has his problems of one kind or another with the patent office. Finding an examiner who understands the technology in the first place is usually the another might be that the guy is too knowledgeable in the industry and too narrow in his take on what the prior art is. In other words, he assumes that the prior art covers everything, including what you're claiming.
Yeah, everything's obvious.
Yeah, everything's obvious. In manufacturing, I would, as opposed to maybe I'd look at it this way, that the more advanced the solution is in manufacturing, such as let's say, for example, that inspection for defects is your area, and you and you know very well that what all the prior art is and the approaches, all the way from using sophisticated IR scanning to just plain vanilla cameras to detect either piece part or web imperfections, then your claims ought to be so clearly outside what's been tried before that the examiner is very much like selling the general manager or the user in the company that you want to buy the technology is unarguably unable to refute your claims.
Mm.
Because otherwise, I think what you're doing is suggesting an improvement on what's been done in the past, which is not where you want to be working. And the game doesn't have enough rewards if you're just improving something that's been done before. And besides, anybody you might say could do that. So that's why I was talking about an order of magnitude difference in cost and performance, if possible, because that then represents it must mean that you're working on a technology that is a leap, such as the use of photonics instead of electronics to do something, or such as discovering and manipulating a way to use frequency to change the behavior of an object or a material and instead of heat, thermal heat.
Mm-hmm.
Departures like that. Because the pain that you referred to is everywhere. Because inertia and NIH is everywhere. Nobody likes change.
Hmm. Okay.
Did I get away with a satisfactory answer to that one?
Well, we'll talk more about it.
Okay, love to. So, should I go on? No more questions right now? The other part of SWOT is opportunities and threats. So, market size and the growth of the market, I said before, so forgive me, this is obvious. But to say a little bit about it is that market size may be larger than you realize in a sort of hidden area. So, the obvious markets of wireless technology, RFID, whatever, may not you know, be any big deal to define in terms of the size of it, but let's say shielding against electromagnetic interference for electronics, against RF microwave guns, which is a threat to any electronic device these days. The Germans are now using an electromagnetic pulse RF gun to stop a speeding vehicle. It shuts down the electronics and the car comes to a halt. It loses power immediately.
How does the pacemaker do? If the driver's wearing a pacemaker, I was wondering.
He should have a
speed. That'll
teach him. Yeah, pacemaker was on too high anyway.
That market size is not obvious, but and this is where the plain vanilla studies don't help you very much. The ones, you know, that Fredonia and Cross and Sullivan and BCC put out about an area that's an obvious market growth area where they think they can sell a lot of studies for $3,000 or $4,000 each. That you won't find a study that covers this area that I just mentioned yet. It may be big and obvious enough to a lot of people where they'll put together, and they do a good job if you don't know much about the industry, because they list everybody and they get some good opinions in their phone conversations with people in the industry. Those markets can be large enough for you to enter. Let's say they're only 100 billion today. And that's a good enough size if you've got a product that you're planning to hope will be a business of, say, 5 million in 5 years, or something like that. And the growth there, of course, is very high as well. You know, we'll be looking at 15 to 30% growth a year in those nascent markets there, the areas. But equally important in looking at the opportunity even is competition. They're not just a threat. The competition helps establish the fact that there is a market there to your customer. They also provide a benchmark for you to beat. They also, in their offerings, show you what has been accepted in the market in terms of how that product works in providing a solution to the customer, so that you can see how your inspiration is truly a different solution and works in a different way and has different costs and is protectable. So competition is extremely useful. They also tell you what the customer is paying right now for a similar solution and helps you not only to see maybe an umbrella under which if they're charging more than they should because they were there first and the market has a big need and they want to pay for it, and you can slide in under an umbrella by having lower costs and start getting into the business that way. But they also, I'm going to say another aspect of that I'll think of it again. The competition is useful to study just as much as the market. Of course, you can't avoid studying the competition when you look at the market in most cases anyway. So again, that may be obvious, but those are the factors that are important about competition. You can look at their size, weight, and power factors, just the specs on their product, and see what their size, their weight, and their efficiency is. And in this day and age of green and energy conservation, anything you can come up with that will save energy, which also includes saving space and saving weight, because in many applications it goes into transportation products, you save energy there by not requiring the platform to use as much energy to get where it's going in your size and weight improvement. So the specs that the competition has available on the web are very helpful and useful. Regulations help and they hurt. This is obvious, but subsidies for solar and wind are an obvious regulation that helps. But if you are packaging something in foam and want to ship it into Europe, you now find you have the regulations there in Europe requiring a high tariff to be paid for that plastic packaging, and you'd better go to paper. So one company with whom I'm working is developing a recycled paper fiber protected packaging solution to foam and bubble pack for shipping fragile products from cosmetics all the way to circuit boards. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering why the regulators decided that foam packaging is so bad. That can be recycled as well and reprocessed and put into other kinds of plastic products.
It does represent a need to separate it from that recycling. And so apparently the Germans are one. They've decided that they just banned plastic flat out because enough of it is still, at least for the first several years, is going to get into landfill. Of course, something that's a little puzzling too, and that's a good question, because they are not doing landfill anymore in Germany, so this really applies to other countries in Europe. But I do know that program of tariffs is now being implemented, and the acronym for it is REACH, R-E-A-C-H, but I don't know what that means yet. In the case of the Germans, they've outlawed landfill. So they're now incinerating everything. You probably know this, and therefore the foam packaging would be fine in that case. So it may be that the Germans are not the culprit there.
A slightly related question. You mentioned earlier in passing Experian, his involvement in Sealed Air's acquisition of Instapak.
Yes.
Are you mentioning this? Is the fact that you're mentioning this somehow related to your involvement with
connect the dots, thank you.
I used to consult the Sealed Air and Instapak and worked with Sherry Snyder, who's the founding CEO of Instapak. So I have a little involvement with that.
That's great, good, yeah. Good.
So is it connected?
I can't say.
Okay.
Regulations obviously can help you and they can hurt you, but it's needful to count that early in the game. And Bob and I were talking at a brief dinner before this, but and I haven't emphasized it enough, but indirectly I have, that when you have the idea, these are all the other factors that you ought to be thinking about, talking with your wife first, as well as your colleagues, because they really impact where you're going to go with the invention and perfecting it on the bench now, not later. You can't leave these things until later to think about it. And, of course, material supply is... critical here, because if you're counting on materials from one supplier, they may go out of business, or a material may be banned from use, and other things like that as well. If you were going to use Borrelia, there's not much chance that'll be banned, but it's so important to our defense. Then action items are the strategic factors that are so important that I wanted to emphasize here. Mostly the first two bullets, estimating the opportunity, which includes the following action steps. Experts are always out there that you probably know most of if you are still inventing in your field of expertise, who are considered, as you've been applying for your patents, you've run across them in the literature. If you're closely associated with an academic institution or with a research house, you will know who the experts are, the gurus are in the industry. Now, they would not be those scientists with whom you would be competing, but the ones that have risen to a point of knowledge in the industry whereby they've had the 30 to 40 years experience in the industry. They know what's been tried, and above all, they know what's going on right now in terms of what companies are trying to bring to the marketplace. In the field of, I'm looking at Mark over here. If Mark would be a good guy to talk to if you were trying to develop a new soldering system that avoids use of lead. That's kind of say now, but he would be a guy that's been through it in terms of developing a knowledge of the industry with lots of resources and backing of a major industrial company like Union Carbide. He would be happy to help you without telling anything about his companies or his own inventions, as to who to talk to, provide opinions as to who's doing what to who. And it's a very quick way to assure yourself that you aren't whistling Dixie with your great idea. You know, I may sometimes say that and inventors and entrepreneurs, all they can hear in their ears is the roaring in their own ears, their own head. It's awfully easy to get excited as heck about your idea. It's a way to
good evening. This is a reminder. It is 8:15 now, and the library will close in 45 minutes at 9 p.m. Thank you.
All right, I'll speed it up here. How does she know that? I should keep going. These studies I had already mentioned, the plain vanilla studies, a study like Frost and Sullivan, is the most popular one. But I found that the donor group, which is mainly English, as I recall, does a very good job. FREEDONIA. Any new idea, when you're thinking of marketing it and the application for it, you need to ask yourself, is there a need? Is there a need now? And does the market know there's a need? If the answer to those three questions is not yes, you better rethink working on this thing. The reason for the first is obvious. That's the need. And that would have to be obvious to a lot of people besides yourself. But is there a need now, or are you kind of looking ahead to when there will be a need several years? If so, rethink working on it, unless it's something you're doing on the side and you can afford to nurture it for a few years until it's obvious to everybody that there is a need. And the other thing that people forget sometimes is that there may have to be education about the need, and that there must be a knowledge, general knowledge of the need now. If only a few people understand the need, maybe one's enough if you can sell your idea to that one. But it's easier to sell it to that one if the need is now, and there's a general knowledge of the need. So is there a need now? And is there a knowledge of the need? When you're forward thinking and visionary, that's outstanding. And not many people are that way. It's not that easy to be that way. but the flip side of that is that you can delude yourself for a long time and waste your time and money if you don't ask yourself these questions. Of course, the resources needed to enter are the intellectual property, and we've probably said enough about that, but allies are extremely important, and Jeffrey Moore brings out the concept of allies better than any book I've ever read about innovation. If you don't know about his book, you might find it fascinating reading. It's Jeffrey, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y? Moore, M-O-O-R-E. He was with McKenna in San Francisco, the marketing firm, and wrote the book called Crossing the Chasm. IBM has taken it to heart, so have many industrials. It's not that old, 5 years maybe. And he emphasizes that in D-Day.
He's written a couple of books since then.
Has he written a couple since then?
Yeah.
I'll bet they're good. I haven't had a chance to read them. Thank you. Well, as you know, he emphasizes that a good example of not only the need to find a champion within the company you're selling your technology to, and a father figure who will see it through, but to bring in the complementary resources that you don't have, like manufacturing, like advisors / experts, like cash, like even complementary technology in another company. This is done with allies like we did in the Second World War when we crossed the Channel to invade Europe. We couldn't have done that unless we put together the consortium of allies that we did and had it coordinated like it was. Manufacturing resources, big need there. That's why I like to focus on large industrials or sometimes a several hundred million dollar company. It's fine if they have the manufacturing capacity, and usually they have more capacity in, let's say, roll coders with a web product like a battery membrane, or they have piece part manufacturing that's unused and picking place and putting together components on a circuit board or manufacturing fiber optic connectors. There are companies that are doing that now, using other technology that's older, that you might want to partner with if you've got an advanced solution in an area where their manufacturing capacity is available, because they're not using all of it. They would, of course, be interested in a piece of your opportunity in return for being an ally. But that's the way the game is played. And of course, sales and distribution is nicely obtained through partnering with larger companies who have market presence. Market presence takes as long to develop as technology. So, and that saves a lot of PR, time, sales effort, cost to get your product to market. And of course, cash. I just point out here in terms of collaboration, which I just touched on, that Sam Palisano has mentioned that this is the age of research, not of research and development, but of research and collaboration. So we can often take a lesson in innovation from even some companies that don't look like they innovate very well.
Uh-huh. Rick, in your world, how important is branding when it comes to resources needed to enter?
Extremely important. I probably should have mentioned it because, and we emphasize this to the companies that come in front of us in the Missile Defense Agency panel, that if they haven't branded or at least trademarked their product, they better get doing that right away, because branding is such an efficient way to communicate both credibility and function and trust. It's like, you know, hearing from a serial entrepreneur. If he says he's going to bring this product to market, you know he's already done it. So I like it. I like branding. I'm not trying to cover everything, you know, so I really appreciate the questions and corrections. In terms of details, these are the ones that have stood out over the years to me as being the least observed in terms of importance. And the first one is the customer. 7 times out of 10, the company that I'm reviewing, a proposal I'm reviewing, the company I'm talking to or evaluating to help, has failed to realize that the one thing that will convince others to invest in them, money, time, is a real customer right now. And if the idea is worth your precious time and effort, it ought to be worthwhile to somebody that it'll make a difference to in terms of their bottom line. And you just somehow got to find that first customer, whoever he might be, however small. In the presentation of your idea to investors, to other potential partners, that first customer is necessary to have. It just advances the credibility of your idea as much as a moonshot. And the distinctive confidence, I'd say at least nothing quite like anything else, is what you've got to get over as the factor that makes you different. Peter Drucker, in his book in 1985, Managing in a Time of Great Change, said that in the theory of business, there are 3 assumptions that need to be made. The first, of course, is assumptions about the environment, which is the culture, the society, the market into which you're selling. But the second one mission. What are you about to do? What's your objective? And I think these, which were written, of course, as he served the large industrial or the large corporation so much, they apply as well to anyone who's trying to bring a new product into market and building a business itself. You got to know what you're trying to do, define your mission, but then most importantly, what is your core competence that sets you apart, that you are in the process of establishing and developing, that's going to certainly be the reason that you accomplish your mission in the environment you operate. Of course, he said that there are four specifications that validate that theory of business. The first is that those 3 things, the environment, the mission, and the core competence have to fit each other. The second, they have to fit reality. And third, they have to be known and understood throughout the organization. And fourth, they have to be tested continuously, because they have to be refined and updated always. So distinctive competence is what have you conceived of and you plan to put in the product, or you put in a product that's so different from anything anybody else has done. How is it different? Why is it different? And you can explain that, and you have to explain it without divulging any IP. You can even say how it works and or why it works, but you don't have to tell them how you made it work. So explaining that distinctive competence, I don't know of a better way to describe it than that. It's absolutely crucial. And I've already talked enough about compelling cost and performance. And I say, you know, time is better than anything else, not just a percentage increase. Ideally 10 times, 100 times, 200.
You put those two together, what if it's something that is very compelling on cost, the performance is equal? Or even the performance is a little lower, but the cost is 20 times.
Good point. Good point.
Can you do one without the other?
Again, I'm trying to go too fast. In that case, one is great, and you should keep going. But if there's no chance, let's say cost is... the two are very different. Let me put it this way. The performance really has to be significantly different. And you, in that way, you can afford to charge, let's say, market price and enter the market. But if you have made an advance which is dramatically different in cost, then it's going to be hard to sell that, even though your performance is just a little better, and almost impossible to sell if the performance is the same. Depending on the market. Okay, so I'll say it again. Performance is the most important factor. I'll put it that way. You've got to have that better, because if it's about the same as the other guy, cost or the price you're going to charge won't get you there.
If I go to, if I have, let's say, a product and it's one tenth the cost of goods sold.
Good evening. The time is now 8:30, and the library will close in 30 minutes at midnight 9 p.m. If you wish to borrow any materials, please come to the circulation desk at this time.
Any
thank you, and have a good evening.
Commodity business, okay.
Any marketeer will just take that cost advantage, drive the market price downward,
true,
and take the competition out of business, and you own the marketplace. So I think a cost of goods sold advantage is powerful. Maybe not as powerful as a performance advantage, but you can do something.
I think each market is different too.
That would be my answer.
Yeah,
because of much lower cost, all of a sudden trickles down to the retailers, the consumer products business, and all of a sudden the retailer is not making as much money.
And you're saying that if you have, let's say, a pair of glasses at one tenth the price, yes, then the retail, yeah.
Because in the radar market, it's all about performance. If I can get double the performance at double the cost, they're going to pay for the one that's double the cost.
That's a special concept.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's each market is different. You know, I can show examples all the way around.
I can think of a product, one that I'm thinking about, and it's a great liability in the present product. Tremendous liability. And 10 times, I think they would pay it.
Because it's a liability.
Just based on that. It's sort of like that panel that dropped out of the Boston Tunnel.
Yeah,
what a terrible. And I would refer to that with what I'm thinking about in my area of work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, absolutely, and you're right too. My point is to think about these factors deeply. Really. And there's no magic answer to what you said. Inertia, I call it the greatest barrier because people are used to resisting change. Organizations into which you're trying to sell are going to first look for reasons not to adopt something new. It's uncomfortable. Not to mention the other factors, which are jealousy, which takes we call it NIH. I had one company go to Ford with a beautiful solution for air conditioning. The whole system fit right underneath the dashboard, electrically driven, And the senior manager looked at his engineer and said, why didn't you think of that? And they proceeded to invent around it after they've been shown the solution. So, you know, inertia can stop it.
Inertia, one of the things we found when I was in the commodity chemical company was that when an industry is forced to change and you have the lowest cost solution, that opens up huge new markets. So things like, and we sold nitrogen for potato chip inerting in a bag so it wouldn't spoil. No one bought it until the market forces said we don't like saturated fats anymore. And they had to use fats that would spoil. And all of a sudden that market blossomed overnight.
So regulation can really help you sometimes.
I find that inertia really resides a lot in manufacturing.
Yes. Well, that's because of the sunk cost in that.
Exactly. The larger the company, the more
right.
The more reticent they are to make any changes because everything's still finely tuned for efficiency purposes.
Well, and that I'll skip over competition. We talked about that enough. Leverage it, you know. But you remind me of the fact that on-ramp is absolutely essential. In manufacturing, you may find where there's an item that's hurt in the line, and you have a solution that will be a small market for you, but it's an on-ramp. Mm-hmm. I'd say take that on-ramp and be happy with it, because there's nothing like demonstrating the adequacy of your solution. It's so convincing, even though it's small in the beginning. And then that can be and blossom through a wider application.
Baby steps.
And sustainability is, you know, the idea that the buyer could perceive that you might not be around tomorrow to supply the product as wonderful as it is that you develop for him, because he thinks you won't be able to sustain your production or your supply to him, and so he turns you off more easily almost than NIA gets it.
Hate to be a party group, but I've just been reminded. They asked, have we heard the announcement? We should always think about wrapping things up. These guys, like,
thank you.
Jet propulsion, they want to get out of here.
Should ask which one, though, the first or the second?
This has been so rewarding to me. I appreciate being able to talk about this stuff, and that is the end of what I plan to cover.
Okay. We have a half an hour, guys. It's only 8:30.
We've got 3 minutes.
In looking in the rearview mirror, what are some of the biggest mistakes or the most common mistakes that you have found among inventors that you've worked with over, or inventing companies that you've worked with over the years?
The most common, number one, is that the founder inventor waits too long to round out his management, so to speak, and the more success he has, the busier he gets trying to address the opportunities, and when he long since should have brought somebody along that could handle a lot of the communication, administration, and watching the few bucks that he has. And so he just gets grown thinner and thinner and wears out. But I don't know anybody that died from it yet. They're still, I know some people my age are still going almost because of it. So that's one. The other is failing to get sufficient IP developed so that his options to attract capital from all sources are limited, because it's awfully hard to judge know-how, particularly when there really isn't a product yet performing in the marketplace. The third would be uh, paying too much for lawyers. How's that?
Rick, can you sit on the panel and review SBIR Phase 1 grant applications? How important is it to the panel to see competitive landscape details in the application?
To which panel, Doug? I didn't get that.
The NSF SBIR Phase 1.
Yeah. Very important, but the most important thing to those panels is the partners that the companies have recruited to, first of all, write a letter saying they will they'll buy the product if and when it's developed. But a better letter is one that says we will put $100,000 in if the phase two is granted. These user larger companies are absolutely critical to the approval of the proposal for funding. Of course, the competitive landscape is real important too, because it's sometimes it's glossed over and hardly mentioned, and it implies that the investigator has really not done a great job there and is unaware of not only the weakness of his, but the strength of others.
Could you elaborate now? When they say competitive landscape, do they just mean an overview of existing technology?
They actually, what's better than that is that has to be in there. But only, not an overview, but just the name of the company and its product. But the most compelling thing is something rarely done, and that is a table which lists the main attributes of your product versus the competitors in size, weight, performance, or other factors that are pertinent to the application area for the technology, and uses real metrics to compare. And yours may not be fully developed yet, but the target performance and cost that you plan to achieve in a matrix versus the competitive offerings now in the marketplace is a very easy and very compelling way to see the difference that you bring to the game. People hate to use metrics in something like that because they think they're going to get held to it, but so people put yes and no, or high and low, and stuff like that, and it's not good to read.
So it sounds like reviewers of NSF SBIR applications are looking for technical comparisons of the product, not like strengths of various business strengths of various established companies.
Yes. Yeah, performance. Mm-hmm. Because
it's about the product. It's not about the company's sales force or their training or the fact that they have good distribution or something like that.
In the commercial section of the proposal, that needs to be filled out, described nicely, how many people doing what. Mm-hmm. Yes, but no adjectives about how good or bad it is, or how good it is. Just facts about the size of the force. And also, extremely important, by the way, is what commercialization has the company done in the past out of technology they've received support for and grants. If they commercialize nothing of the previous grants they've received in previous years, that's a signal that it's just an R&D house. And there are too many of those in this country. They're pretty good at writing proposals, but nothing comes of it.
And they keep getting
it. Even NSF, really, they focus, they emphasize, although you think that NSF should be the provider of advances in science for our country, they are chartered, literally, to make sure that stuff gets commercialized. MDA, on their part, wants to make sure this stuff gets commercialized because they're not going to use it in a platform for at least 10 years. it will not be mature enough to be deployed in a manned or even unmanned platform. By the way, unmanned aerial systems is a hot market. I'm doing work in that area. Yes, sir.
There was an article in Times, I think, within the last week, in respect to trying to raise money, and it said that everybody, of course, puts in an elaborate business plan and cash flow and so forth. And basically, the result of the study said that this is worthless, that they had no bearing on whether the cash was raised or not, and apparently, quoted a number of people said they don't believe any of them and they never really look at them. Did you care to comment?
In the what agency are they that they've been put?
Not a government, it's a private
venture
funding, angel.
I'm missing the first part because I couldn't hear. People have written a lot of proposals to angels and VCs.
Most of these proposals contain an elaborate business plans and cash flows, and every MBA
writes
them. And the pertinent study basically was a study of funds raised, and they came to the conclusion that these plans had no bearing whatsoever. And then there were some discussions having talked with some people, and said they completely discounted being meaningless. Look at the other things, many of which you mentioned, type of thing, sales customers, whatever. But that was one thing they apparently university said they don't. But every proposal contains an elaborate plan. I was wondering if you had any comment on your own experience.
I'm guessing that the article is talking about the projection.
Yes.
The plan showed my naivete or lack of knowledge about a market that was not going to get funded.
Oh, but that was the other. They weren't being not believed.
Nobody believed the projections. But if you show that you don't understand the market, then you're likely, very unlikely to get funded.
That's a
so a bad plan will eliminate you.
So you're referring to plans that are beautifully done by a Harvard MBA, but there's no substance to the technology and the no indication of knowledge of the market?
It didn't say it in the article, but the implication must have been that the readers at least believed there was no substance behind it. Yeah.
And projections look like hockey sticks.
Yeah.
Miracle. Well, in my experience, to try to answer your question, is that I've seen lots of well-written proposals, but I've never seen one where someone wasted their time writing about proposing funding something that didn't have some substance to it, however marginal as to its usefulness. Such a proposal that's well written in terms of containing all of the necessary ingredients that should be in a business plan, which I have an outline here for, but you can get anywhere. This library probably has 100 books on writing a business plan. Must be built around something substantive, otherwise no one is going to look at it. I'm sorry, I'm not really answering your question, I don't believe.
Now I realize where I should have cut it. I'll have to try and recover.
The
main distinction was, I think,
good evening. It is nearly 10 minutes of 9, and the library will close in just about 10 minutes. If you wish to borrow any materials, please come to the circulation desk at this time. Please collect your personal belongings and exit the building. Thank you, and have a very nice evening.
The main distinction between it being useful to the company versus useful to raise funding.
Are anybody interested in these PR level technology readiness level definitions? And there's a manufacturing readiness level.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Rick.
After these meetings, we typically head down the hill to Archie Moore's.